I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Charlie Smith is the editor of the Georgia Strait. He has been at the helm of the paper for nearly 5 years now, but he's been there since 1994. The Strait, which comes out Thursdays, is Canada's largest weekly, with a weekly audience of nearly 700,000 readers. It has had a long tradition in the city, first as a rambunctious alternative in the 1960s to becoming an award-winning publication with an audience highly coveted by advertisers. We'll discuss the paper and its place in today's media market, the market what it is, of course, as well as the Olympic Games around us and whatever else is on his radar. The Strait has a special place in my heart as I spent a week there on a career placement back in high school. It was a neat place, and we'll check in now. I'm pleased to welcome to the Planta Online program Charlie Smith. Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Oh, good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
The Olympics. Were you... what was your opinion on the Olympics early on?
Well, early on I had serious concerns, and I wrote several stories about the IOC and its structure and the fact that the organizing committee in Vancouver is not covered by some pieces of legislation that deal with basic accountability of government operations, and that includes things like the Financial Disclosure Act or the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, Financial Information Act, Document Disposal Act, the list goes on. And it did seem that these games were almost a stalking horse to get large capital projects approved that were in the queue and were not deemed to be deserving of government support. But once the games came in, the federal government would bring forward a pile of money, and examples are the Canada Line, because the major problem with transportation in metropolitan Vancouver is east-west, but this is a north-south line, and it cost a couple of $1 billion. The other was the expansion to the Vancouver Convention Center, which couldn't be justified on business reasons, but they needed a big center for an international broadcast center for the media during the Olympics, so that was the justification for going ahead. And they were able to squeeze a couple hundred million bucks out of the federal government. So those were my main concerns. It wasn't so much the hosting of the Olympics. It was the ancillary capital projects that I didn't feel were necessary, or that there were more important projects that should go ahead.
And when we sober up from these games in the next several weeks or so, do you think, I mean, is a possibility there that we'll find out things that we don't know thus far about perhaps debt and the sort? And
well, I think we may, but I believe that a lot of the money was spent in the years leading up to the event as opposed to during the event. There was a lot of money obviously spent during the event, and on a micro scale, just the premier flying around the country with the Olympic torch, I'd love to see how much he spent on hotel bills and meals and restaurants. Like, was it really necessary for him to go, you know, basically take a sabbatical from his job so he could crisscross the country with the Olympic torch? Yeah. But in terms of the percentage of overall government spending, I think the expense that I'm looking at is the city's expense. That's where we had this plebiscite in 2003, and we were left with the impression, oh, you know, if there's any cost overruns, it's going to be handled by the provincial government, because they had were a guarantor. The problem with that was there were separate facilities like the curling rink or the Trout Lake practice arena or the extra policing costs that were being borne by city taxpayers. And we don't know how much that's going to end up costing.
What have you thought, though, of the spectacle of it all the last few weeks here in the city?
You must admit it's pretty fun to have, you know, if you have a great party in your town. It has been really something to see, and I think the athletes and their performances, I've been caught up in it and watching it and enjoying it. I think it's fun to see the women doing so well on the, you know, bobsleigh and Joni Richet, and watching these performances. But at the same time, it's been very expensive. If I was living in Richmond and I paid for that Olympic oval, and you're looking at, I don't know, I think it's about 140 or 150 million bucks. Richmond isn't that large of a municipality. That's a big cost. It's going to be converted into a community center, but there are questions about, you know, the soil stability and things of that nature. And is that the best use of its kind of civic funds. Maybe they think it is.
What have you thought of the media's coverage of the games? First, the local press. And
I think the media coverage has been a little too boosterish for my liking. We've tried to cover it from both sides. I think the protests, it's not as if there wasn't a reason for these people to be protesting, but I think they were just dismissed out of hand. I think there are conflicts of interest where media organizations like CanWest or CTV are official sponsors, and so I think they have a vested interest in promoting the games and maybe downplaying the maybe some of the more negative stories, such as the you know, what happened at Live City, where 19 people were injured when a barricade collapsed. I think the let's ask ourselves, if the athlete who was killed at the Whistler Sliding Center, if that athlete had been Canadian as opposed to Georgian, would the media have covered it differently? Would they have been more aggressive in their examination of that Whistler Sliding Center? I think they probably would have been. So I do feel that at times the media has treated it like a party when it's actually a pretty big public expense, and I don't think they've treated it with the same seriousness, perhaps, as other things of this magnitude.
How about through the international lens? How do you think we've looked?
I think internationally it's been mixed. You know, the British journalists I haven't paid a ton of attention to the international coverage. I've seen some. I think in the United States it's been very positive, like just from what I've been reading in the New York Times, and the, you know, there's the death of the Georgian loser obviously didn't make us look so good. But I also think that it hasn't been as catastrophic. I think the British journalists are being British journalists, and that's the way they are. And they have, it's not that they haven't had validity to some of the things they've written. I heard a funny one that was in Pravda, where they were saying Vancouver's dressed up like lamb, but it's but it's actually a mutton city, and that kind of made me smile. But the Russians have had some critical commentary as well. I think the major importance for Canada in terms of business and tourism and all of that is primarily the American market, and I don't think the coverage has been as bad there.
Yeah. I noticed on the website, the Straits website, straight.com, that lately it's been just a great source of information between issues.
Mm-hmm.
And has that been something that you've tried to do more of?
Yeah, what we've done, it's the company has tried to become, you know, a source of information 7 days a week. And we're a weekly paper, but we have straight.com, which is a daily source. The other thing, we have some fantastic young people working on the site. Stephen Hoy, who we just appointed as our web editor, he used to be the head of Canadian University Press, and he was an editor of the SFU Peak, and he worked for the Toronto Sun, and he's been with us for about 3 years, and he's our technology editor, but he's very strong in news. He's been soliciting a lot of commentaries. Travis Lupik, who's traveled the world, young guy, graduate from McGill, 24, 25 years old, just really smart. And he's kind of like the managing editor of the site, and he's doing a ton of things. And then we've got Miranda Nelson, who used to edit the school paper at Malaspina College. I guess it's now called Vancouver Island University. And she's, you know, making sure all the links are there and all the, you know, she's working really hard. And we've got a team of people, plus the, you know, the programmers downstairs on the, we've got three floors in our building. And I think the staff people have been doing a lot of contributions, like reporters like Carlito Pablo or Matt Burrows are writing stories that are web-only. And so there's a lot of content on the website that isn't appearing in the paper. And I like writing for the web because to get the comments going, and we take pride in having quite a freewheeling site. You know, there are always problems with Canadian media law, which is lags behind the Americans in terms of the ability to do as much as you want. But we do have some pretty roaring debates, and I don't mind if people take a strip off me. There was one where I said military leaders should undergo screening tests for psychopathy, and I think military people across the country were jumping all over me and saying, maybe the editor of the Georgia Strait should be screened for psychopathy. That was kind of fun.
Yeah. Like, I see, like, earlier today you had, on the Twitter, I read that you had the story about Anthony Sedlak out as a chef at that restaurant that they were promoting him at. I mean, you wouldn't get that anywhere else, I don't think.
Yeah.
And you've been quoted in other, like, I mean, I read some of the sort of Toronto journalism websites and so on, and they quote the Strait frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The paper...
Might be our publicity machine, Joseph.
Yeah, there you go, yeah. The paper and what it's meant to Vancouver, it's obviously changed from what it was in the 60s, hasn't it?
Yeah, it started as an underground kind of hippie newspaper, promoting, drug use and strong opposition to the Vietnam War, and even some of the early people who worked here were on the first Greenpeace voyage up to Alaska. Paul Watson used to work here, who's the head of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and so it was pretty radical. It wasn't financially that successful, and then it morphed into an entertainment paper for a long time, and then a big thing happened in 1982 when Dan McLeod, the publisher who still owns the paper and still comes into the office every day, Dan decided to make it a free newspaper, and that was a turning point. And I joked to him that he was kind of ahead of his time because, Google has made all this money by offering free content and then wrapping ads around it. And I said, well, we were doing that in the newspaper business, offering the paper for free, having the content for free, and then the ads kind of go around it. And that seems to be the model that's working on the Internet, maybe to the detriment of newspapers.
Yeah. As the editor, how do you see your role in looking back at the past and its heritage and moving forward?
I think we have to be an alternative. At the same time, we do have a mass readership, and you want the paper to be picked up every week, because if it's not picked up, because one of the things about our paper, it's not like, say, the community papers like the Vancouver Courier or the West Ender. What they do is, well, maybe less so with the West Ender, but a lot of the community papers, they're dropped off on people's doorsteps, and then people pick it up, they take it in, they do whatever they do with it. If they read it, they don't read it. Our paper is almost entirely a voluntary pickup. It's sitting at the library, or it's sitting in news boxes or in coffee shops, and people have to actually consciously pick it up and make that choice. And so it does put the pressure on to get the distribution. But the other thing, I think what I like to do is try to have articles that are not appearing in other media. I think our coverage of the protests during the Olympics was clearly different than what you were getting in other media. Like I said to Carlito, I said, why don't you call up Mark Lear, who's a historian who looks at protests, and he was saying, looking at anarchism and this activity that happened in Vancouver and then putting it in historical context. I think our coverage of H1N1 flu vaccine, I got Alex Roslin to write an article that was looking like what's in this vaccine, and it was quite challenging to the kind of public health officials who were promoting the vaccine. And I think our coverage of the Afghanistan war is different than what you're seeing in the mainstream media. I think with one exception, maybe Bill Kaufman at the Calgary Sun, but for the most part, maybe Eric Margolis in Toronto, but for the most part, I think the media is very supportive of the war in Afghanistan, and I think they fail to see that, one of the things I asked Carlito Pablo, who he's one of our reporters, he's from the Philippines, and when he came to work, I said, Carlito, what do you think of the Afghanistan war? And he said, it's kind of like Vietnam without the jungle.
Yeah.
And I felt that was quite an accurate comment, and Gwyn Dyer, who's our international affairs correspondent, has a column on our site today basically looking at guerrilla war, the history of guerrilla war, how it's been successful in the post-imperial age, and whether Afghanistan is another example of that. We're not seeing that in the other media. So I think what we can do, and on environmental coverage, is try to hit these points that the other media aren't hitting, and I hope that can keep us going as long as we've gone.
And how well has the paper done through this economic storm?
We've done okay. I think all the newspapers are having challenges. I was happy that in 2009 we didn't have to lay off any editorial staff, and we hired two young women. One was to do listings, and the other was Miranda to work on the website. We've just put an ad in the paper, actually, to hire two more people on our website. Most of our new hires are going on the web, and but we've done okay. We're not. It's not like the glory years of 2007, but it's not calamitous, and we're still getting profit-sharing checks at the end of the year, if that gives you any indication.
Yeah. The state of journalism, though, not only in this city but across the country, is what? I mean, does it worry you? I mean, we're seeing CanWest, they own a great deal of outlets in this country, television and in print, and they seem to be going under.
Yeah, I think the model seems to be broken, and part of it is Google, which is this kind of rapacious monster that is, you know, I think last year Ken Auletta wrote a great book called Googled, and it was, you know, I think he said they did $21 billion U.S. in sales last year, which was more than the, or in 2008, actually, I believe, was, but more than the four U.S. networks combined. They've got people like Rupert Murdoch and Bill Gates on the defensive, and so that's one issue. I think another issue is with the Internet, there are so many choices, like, for instance, your site, where people can go to thecommentary.ca and listen to an interview. They don't have to pay for it. and it's out there. And so you don't have media outlets as these big filters anymore. There's just all this information. So I wonder what that means. Does it mean print editions of newspapers? I still think people like picking up print editions. I like to think that we're in possibly a better position because we're a weekly, and that maybe the dailies are having a tougher time. I think we're going to see a shakeout in this market in Metro Vancouver. I wonder how we can sustain two community papers in virtually every suburb, you know, like a suburb like Delta or Richmond or New Westminster, where they have two community papers, and then you've got two daily papers, and then you've got two commuter papers, and you've got two national papers. And I wonder if we're going to have one daily paper, one commuter paper, one national paper, and one community paper within a few years. And I think that might be part of, you never know, like possibly we'll see much more population growth or rampant economic expansion, but as things stand now, I think there are probably too many papers for the population when you throw in the Internet.
Yeah. I've been asking guests this week about what the games mean to the country. There's been talk now that these Winter Games have been sort of a nation-defining moment for the country and for Canadians. Do you see it as that?
I wonder if that's a little extreme. I think in the throes of it, it is very exciting, but I'm not even sure it's as nation-defining as you get outside of Metro Vancouver. I heard three people on Bill Good this morning who are, you know, radio broadcasters, and they were going, you know, there's no public celebrations in Victoria or in the West Kootenays or in Kelowna, and people are enjoying the games on TV. Some of them are wearing hockey jerseys. I also think these Olympics have not fully captured the multicultural fabric of the country. I think that how engaged people are, I'm not sure how engaged new Canadians are in this Olympic adventure, we're on. I think winter sports tends to appeal to wealthier people who, you know, can afford to go skiing and snowboarding and do a lot of these activities. I think the summer games tend to be a little more egalitarian in that you have athletes from poor countries, rich countries. You know, an Ethiopian can win the marathon. It doesn't seem to be the case with the winter games. So to say it's nation-defining, I kind of question that. I wonder if, you know, the Globe and Mail and CTV Globe Media is into this, you know, in a big way. They might like to characterize it that way, but I'm not so sure.
And finally, the HST, your website and your paper have covered it far differently than other press. The debate's not over yet, right?
Well, I don't think it is, but the one area, it looks like it's coming in. I can't see, I'm wondering, the budget, provincial budget's coming in early March. I think it's March 2nd, and the federal budget is March 4th. And I wonder if they might back off a bit on the percentage and throw the public a bone and go, okay, it's not going to be 12%, it's going to be 10%. I think the big risk for the conservatives federally and even the federal liberals who have backed this thing is whether there's going to be a backlash and New Democrats are going to do very well across the province in the federal election by opposing the HST. We saw this in New Westminster Coquitlam when Finn Donnelly just won a landslide victory over the conservative candidate, and this was a riding that had switched back and forth. Coquitlam, the Coquitlam part is not really a heavy New Democrat stronghold. They win the seat from time to time provincially, but not by any large margin. And I think Jack Layton is kind of licking his chops at this HST and saying, wow, we could take Surrey North, we can take Newton North Delta, we can take, we can hold New Westminster Coquitlam, we won't have a problem in Burnaby Douglas, we might even, we'll hold Vancouver Kingsway, and so I think that might force the conservatives to ameliorate the effects somehow, and maybe they'll do something in tandem in the two budgets.
What about
coming
this
in March?
What about this campaign that Van der Zem's on?
Yeah, that one actually could. That's a good point you make, Joseph, and that, you know, it could conceivably work. You just never know. It's not too much hassle to sign a petition and to get 10% in each constituency. So, yeah, I don't think it's out of the question, actually.
Charlie, you're good to do this. I appreciate this.
Oh, I appreciate coming on, Joseph, and I'm a fan of your site, and you're doing a great job, and thanks for calling.
Thanks very much, and we hope to do this again.
Okay, great.
The website for more is straight.com. The Georgia Strait hits the streets every Thursday. It's editor Charlie Smith on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.